Janie Cantrell leaned over the back of the wagon seat and anxiously watched the sheriff lead Matt Bodine and Sam Two Wolves away.
What are we going to do, Charity? We can't just let them be locked up.
Janie was 19 and hadn't been a soiled dove for very long, just a couple of years. Even though Charity was only 24, she often felt like the gulf between their ages was huge. She could only imagine what it must feel like to be Lydia, who had been a whore for more than half her life until Charity had offered her a chance to escape from all that, the same chance she had offered the other girls. She knew Janie was upset not only because Matt and Sam had been taken into custody unjustly, but also because the younger girl had already fallen hard for Bodine. Charity had seen it in Janie's eyes. Men were usually the ones who were romantic fools. Otherwise, they wouldn't believe it when red light ladies told them they loved them or that they were the best they'd ever had. But the same crazy notions sometimes afflicted gals, too, especially ones like Janie. Just because Matt Bodine was tall and handsome, she had already convinced herself that she was in love with him.
We can't stop the sheriff from locking them up, but maybe we can help get them out of jail. We'll go see Judge Ashmore. I'm sure he can round up some witnesses who'll testify that those other men drew first and that Bodine and Two Wolves were just defending themselves. The sheriff won't have any choice but to release them.
You sure?
Of course. Haven't I been right about everything so far? We're here, aren't we?
We're here, all right. From the sound of it, somebody doesn't want us here. Do you know anything about this fella Cole?
Not a thing. Lydia, I never heard of him until the sheriff mentioned him. Let's go find that lawyer's office.
She lifted the reins and flapped them against the backs of the team, getting the wagon rolling. A few buildings down, she spied some men on the boardwalks.
Pardon me, sir? I'm looking for Judge Ashmore. Sir?
The men eyed her and the other girls they could see, but turned away without answering. One gave Charity an insolent wink. Charity set her jaw and kept driving. Lydia glanced at her.
Looks like they don't want to talk to you.
Maybe they don't know.
Or maybe they just don't want anybody to see them talking to a bunch of whores.
That's all behind us now. As far as anybody here in Buffalo Flat is concerned, we're just as respectable as anybody else.
Oh, honey. You know that's not true. Hell, you heard what the sheriff said. The whole town must know who we are.
Charity caught her bottom lip between her teeth. She knew Lydia was right. She had tried her best to keep the truth from arriving before them. She had signed all the letters she'd sent to Judge Ashmore as C.A. McKenzie. Somehow, though, the word had gotten around.
It doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter.
The light was fading fast, but enough of it remained for her to spot a sign hanging from the awning over the boardwalk. It read, Judge A.A. Ashmore, one flight up. An arrow pointed up a flight of stairs attached to the side of the building, the ground floor of which housed an apothecary shop. Charity brought the wagon to a halt and peered up the stairs. The second floor windows were lit. Somebody was up there. She hooked the reins around the brake lever and looked at Lydia.
Stay here. I'll go see about this.
Lydia patted the stock of the shotgun in her lap.
We'll be right here.
Charity jumped from the wagon to the boardwalk and started up the stairs, clutching the railing as she climbed. Her throat was tight. Despite the confidence she tried to exhibit, especially around the other women, she had known going into this thing that it wouldn't be easy. She had expected to encounter obstacles in getting the townspeople to accept them. She hadn't figured on getting shot at, though. When she reached the landing at the top of the stairs, she rapped smartly on the door.
Come in.
An aromatic blend of pipe tobacco and old leather filled the air as Charity opened the door and stepped into the lawyer's office, carefully shutting the door behind herself. The tobacco smell came from the briar clenched between the teeth of the man seated behind a paper-cluttered desk. Shelves full of thick leather-bound volumes contributed the other smell. They were sets of law books, Charity guessed. The man was fat, with a round, ruddy face and a short, neatly trimmed, gray-shot beard. He took the pipe out of his mouth as he looked up at her.
Judge Ashmore?
That's right. Ambrose Aloysius Ashmore, at your service, my dear. And you are?
Charity Ann McKenzie.
The friendly, somewhat lecherous twinkle that had been in Ashmore's eyes an instant earlier vanished.
Miss McKenzie, You might have told me what the initials stood for instead of keeping me in the dark. I'm afraid you've made me look foolish.
I'm sorry, but I don't see how that could be.
When I executed old Archibald Mackenzie's will, I assumed he was leaving the Silver Bell to a male relative.
And what difference does that make? Archibald was my great-uncle, and he wanted me to have the saloon. That's all that should matter.
We shall see. We shall see. In the meantime, I take it you've come to Buffalo Flat to take possession of the property?
That's right.
The lawyer set down his pipe and reached for his hat.
Very well. I suppose I can take you over there.
Actually, there's another matter that needs to be dealt with first. I want to engage your services on behalf of two men who were just taken to jail by the sheriff.
Ashmore sat back in his chair and raised his rather bushy eyebrows.
Indeed. This doesn't have anything to do with that shooting I heard a short time ago, does it?
As a matter of fact, it does. Two men who were defending me and my friends as well as themselves were forced to shoot some ruffians. It was a clear-cut case of self-defense in front of numerous witnesses. The sheriff had no right to arrest them.
Sherman Branch knows the boundaries of the law pretty well. If he locked up these friends of yours, I'm sure he thought he had good reason to do so.
As Charity tried to contain her anger and exasperation, she still couldn't help but wonder at Ashmore, referring to Bodine and Two Wolves as her friends. Were they? She had known the two men only a matter of hours, but she recalled how both of them had risked their own lives without hesitation to help her and the other women. Yes, she decided, they were her friends, at least until they gave her reason to believe otherwise.
Judge, my companions and I will all testify that there was no crime committed. I'm sure if you ask around, you can find other witnesses who'll tell the sheriff the same thing. I think if we move fast, we can get Mr. Bodine and Mr. Two Wolves out of jail tonight.
Ashmore sat up sharply and held out a hand to stop her.
What did you say their names are?
Matt Bodine and Sam Two Wolves. Why do people keep reacting that way? One of the men who challenged them backed off when he found out who they were.
I should think so. These two friends of yours, my dear, are notorious gunfighters. Why, I can't think of anyone who's killed more men than Matt Bodine, except maybe Smoke Jensen.
Charity was shaken, but tried not to show it. She had seen for herself how proficient with their guns Matt and Sam were, but it hadn't occurred to her that they might be famous, or infamous, as the case might be.
Regardless of their reputations, they're innocent of any wrongdoing in these shootings. You have to help them, Judge.
I don't have to do anything, young lady. But I suppose I can go down and have a talk with Sheriff Branch. By the way, who did they kill?
The sheriff said one of the men was named Ed Tully. That's all I know.
Tully? The one who works for Junius Cole?
I think that's what the sheriff said. This man Cole should be investigated and probably locked up. I believe he must be the person who sent those men to ambush me and my friends.
Oh, I doubt that. Junius Cole is a respected businessman in this town.
I've known a lot of so-called respected businessmen, Judge. Some of them were scoundrels.
Yes, I imagine you have known plenty of businessmen.
He reached for his hat again and heaved himself to his feet as Charity trembled a little with anger at the insinuation.
I'll take you and your friends to the Silver Bell. Then I'll look into this other matter.
I'm counting on your legal integrity, Judge.
Yes, yes. Sometimes integrity, legal and otherwise, is a damned inconvenient thing to have.
The front doors of the Silver Bell were closed and locked. Judge Ashmore dug a key out of his coat pocket to unlock them.
Nobody's been in here since old Archibald died, and that was several months ago, so it may be a bit dusty and musty inside.
We can clean it up. We'll spruce it up just fine.
Lydia still had the shotgun in her hands as she and Charity stood on the boardwalk with Ashmore. The other four women remained in the wagon, but they leaned out from under the canvas cover at the front to watch as the lawyer opened up the saloon. Ashmore stepped back to let Charity and Lydia go first. It was dark inside, of course, but Charity had brought one of the lanterns from the wagon, and as she raised it in her hand, the glow from it spread out around the big room. The long hardwood bar was to the right, with a staircase to the second floor at the end of it. To the left were round tables where customers could sit and drink, plus faro layouts, a roulette wheel, and several baize-topped tables for poker games. A small stage was at the far end of the room with a real piano next to it. A player piano sat against the wall in the front left corner. Charity lifted her eyes to the balcony that ran around the room. There were rooms up there on the second floor that could be rented out or used as sleeping quarters for her and the other girls. As to whether or not there would be anything else going on in those rooms, well, Charity hadn't made up her mind about that yet. She and her friends had come here to put that part of their lives behind them. But what was a frontier saloon without whores? That decision could be put off until later, she told herself. For now, it was enough to know that they would have to clean the place up, make sure it was well stocked with liquor, maybe hire a bartender or two. Lydia caught her eye and smiled a trifle.
Looks like the place is in pretty good shape. A little dusty, like you said, Judge. And some cobwebs here and there. But it won't take us long to have everything shining.
Charity set the lantern on the bar and looked up at the chandeliers hanging from the ceiling.
Including those. They're already pretty shiny, even with a layer of dust on them.
They're silver. Archibald paid a pretty penny to have them hauled out here from St. Louis, along with that big mirror behind the bar. He didn't mind putting money into the place, that's for sure. He was well on the way to making a big success of it when he got sick.
What did he die of? I never was really sure about that.
No way you could be sure, when the doctor didn't even know.
The doctor didn't know what was wrong with my great-uncle?
No, he did not. It was a mystery, Dr. Bradford said. He'd never seen anything like it before. Some sort of stomach grip. Archibald couldn't keep any food down. It kept getting worse, and after a couple of weeks, he just couldn't fight it anymore. He was getting along in years, you know.
I know. Still, it's sort of strange that he would have gotten sick and died so quickly like that, isn't it?
Well, you'd have to ask a physician, my dear. The law is my specialty, not medicine. I suppose you'll be wanting the key.
Yes, thank you.
Charity took the key Ashmore held out to her and tucked it into one of the pockets of her dress.
Thank you for everything.
Ashmore scowled and looked uncomfortable.
No need for thanks. Just doing my job. I don't have to like it.
You don't like us very much either, do you, Judge?
Buffalo Flat is a peaceful town. I don't like to see people come in and stir everything up and cause trouble.
Maybe it's peaceful only because nobody wants to stand up to Junius Cole. Did you ever think of that?
The lawyer's scowl darkened even more.
Janie!
Earlier that afternoon, when Beau and Scratch arrived at the Half Moon Ranch with Teresa Kincaid, Beau was impressed with the layout. This was no greasy sack outfit. It had been built up with care over the years. The main house especially looked sturdy and comfortable. If you knew what to look for, though, there were signs that the place was going slightly downhill. The corral fences could have used some tightening up, and one of the hinges on a barn door was loose, causing the door to hang a little askew. The roof of the same barn needed some patching. Those were the sort of chores that went undone when a spread was short-handed, as Teresa had said that the Half Moon was.
Well, now, this is a mighty nice-looking place, ma'am. We'll be tolerable proud to work here, won't we, Bo?
Looks like there's work to be done, all right.
Now, don't you mind that old grump, Miss Teresa. Bo could find something to complain about if he was being served cake and cream.
I know there are chores that need to be taken care of, Mr. Creel. We had all we could do just tending to the stock and trying to stay alive.
Yes, ma'am, I expect so. Maybe it'll all be a mite easier for you now that Scratch and I are here.
Oh, I hope so. Let's go. I'll introduce you to the other hands.
As they splashed across the ford, several men emerged from a long, low log building that Beau figured was the bunkhouse. They carried rifles and stood tensely alert. Teresa drove up in front of the ranch house and brought the buckboard to a halt. Beau and Scratch reined in beside her. The oldest of the hands, a middle-aged gent with a bristly gray mustache, stepped forward.
It's mighty good to see that you got back all right, Miss Teresa. Never should have gone off to Buffalo Flat like that by yourself.
Oh, don't scold me, Hardy. You're not my father.
No, ma'am, I ain't.
The man called Hardy regarded Beau and Scratch with narrowed eyes.
Who are these two old pelicans?
Watch who you're calling old, friend. I'd say we don't have too many years on you.
This is Mr. Morton and Mr. Creel. They gave me a hand when some of Cole's gunmen ambushed me on the way home.
Are you all right, ma'am?
Oh, I'm fine. Not a scratch. And I didn't lose any of the supplies either, so the trip was a success all the way around. Plus, I got two more hands out of it.
You two figure to work here, do you?
Miss Kincaid asked us to sign on and ride for the Half Moon. We said we would.
Hardy's frown didn't go away, but he seemed to relax slightly.
In that case, light down. There are empty stalls in the barn for your horses.
The two drifters from Texas swung down from their saddles. Scratch stuck out a hand, which Hardy shook.
Scratch Morton. Hardy Thomas is my name. These are the Rannies, Johnny Del Rio, Mort Skaggs, Hector Ibanez.
Bo Creel.
Bo shook hands in turn with the four punchers. Skaggs and Ibanez were well-seasoned cowboys in their 30s, while Johnny Del Rio was the youngest of the bunch, a strapping blonde hombre around 20 years old. None of the men seemed to have heard of Bo or Scratch before, which was just fine with the two drifters. They had been mixed up in enough fracases over the years that sometimes they ran into folks who recognized their names. But Bo preferred to soft-pedal their reputation, such as it was.
Let's get these supplies unloaded while Mr. Morton and Mr. Creel are tending to the horses.
I want to hear more about that ambush. What happened to the bushwhackers? They get away?
Our two new friends happened to the bushwhackers. Only one of them got away. And I'm pretty sure he had a bullet in his shoulder as he galloped off.
Dollars to donuts, he ran straight back to Buffalo Flat and told Cole what happened.
Hardy set his rifle in the back of the buckboard and lifted one of the boxes of supplies. The other men moved to help him. Johnny hefted a couple of bags of flour and balanced one on each shoulder as he started toward the house. As Bo and Scratch led their horses into the barn, Bo glanced sideways at Scratch.
What do you think of the crew Miss Kincaid has left?
Well, they seem like a decent bunch. Hardy strikes me as a salty old jigger. Can't really tell about the others, except the boy. He's got calf eyes for Miss Teresa. I can't say I blame him either. She is one fine-looking woman.
And young enough to be your daughter to boot.
I don't have a daughter. Leastways, not that I know of.
They unsaddled their mounts, rubbed them down, and settled the animals in stalls. By the time they were through, all the supplies had been carried in. Bo and Scratch slung their war bags over their shoulders and headed toward the house. Teresa stepped out on the porch and smiled.
Well, make yourselves at home. There are empty bedrooms here in the house, if you'd like.
Thanks, but that wouldn't hardly be proper. We'll bunk with the other hands, that's all right with you.
Of course. Whatever you like, Mr. Creel.
That's another thing, ma'am. If we're going to be working for you, why don't you go ahead and call me Bo?
And I'm Scratch. No point in standing on formality.
All right. Well, that's fine.
What are your orders, ma'am?
You mean as far as the work goes? It's late enough in the day. You don't need to worry about that. I'm sure Hardy'll tell you what to do in the morning. He's my foreman, and he really runs things around here since William died.
I've been meaning to ask you about that, if you don't mind talking about it. You said he was shot in the back?
Teresa nodded, the smile disappearing from her face and being replaced by a look of anger more than sorrow.
That's right. He was riding out on our range when someone ambushed him. Oh, I'm convinced it was one of Cole's men, of course. The sheriff said there was no proof of that since no one saw it happen. We've been having some trouble with rustlers, losing some stock now and then. Something else I'm convinced Cole is behind. And Sheriff Branch said it was more likely William was killed by a rustler. I'll never believe that, though.
Who found your husband?
I did. He was gone longer than I expected him to be, so I went out looking for him. Back then, I didn't realize it was quite so dangerous to be doing something like that.
Was he a young fella?
No. William was considerably older than me. He started the Half Moon more than 10 years ago.
I thought it looked like the spread had been here for a while.
Yes. William worked long and hard to make the ranch successful. And then it was all taken away from him in the time it takes to pull a trigger.
Tears sparkled in her eyes as she spoke. Scratch shifted from one foot to the other.
Well, now, maybe we better mosey on out to the bunkhouse. We didn't mean to upset you, Miss Teresa.
Oh, don't worry about it. Please, most of the time I'm just fine. I just hate to think about Cole getting away with all those terrible things he's done.
Most folks get what's coming to them sooner or later, one way or another. But with me and Bo here, maybe it'll be sooner instead of later for that hombre Cole.
Just be careful. That's all I ask. I don't want to see anyone else get killed.
I reckon that'll be up to Cole.
Bo and Scratch tipped their hats to Teresa and headed toward the bunkhouse. The western sky was red with the swift approach of sunset. As Bo and Scratch approached the bunkhouse, they saw Hardy Thomas emerge hurriedly from the building.
Either you gents seen Johnny?
Not since y'all were taking the supplies into the house. Something wrong?
Damn it. I think that damn hothead kid's gone and ridden into town to look for trouble. He was talking about how we couldn't let Cole get away with having his gunnies ambush Miss Teresa. Said somebody was gonna have to teach Cole a lesson. Now I can't find him.
Check the barn for his horse.
That's just what I was on my way to do.
Hardy stalked into the barn with Bo and Scratch following him. The foreman opened the door and looked at the first stall.
Shit! That's where Johnny always keeps his nag. Damn fool's gone after Cole.
I suppose Cole's got gunmen around him most of the time.
Yeah. Kid'll get himself shot to doll rags if he ain't careful. Somebody's got to stop him from getting killed. It'll bust up Miss Teresa if he did. I gotta go get him back.
Better let us go. We can find him and bring him back before he gets into trouble.
Just point us towards town.
You fellas may not know what you'd be getting yourselves into.
We tangled with Cole's men once today already, remember?
We came out on top, too.
Hardy rubbed his grizzled jaw for a second, and then nodded.
Yeah, that's true. But your horses are about played out. You need to take fresh mounts.
You know the stock better than we do. Pick out a couple of good horses and we'll get saddled up.
Just don't say anything to Miss Teresa about it. No need in worrying her. We'll find the boy, bring him right back here.
All right. Cole spends most of his time in the Colorado Palace Saloon. He owns the place, lives there too. You can't miss it. It's the biggest, fanciest saloon in town. Dollars to donuts, that's where Johnny will look for him.
We'll find him.
After Hardy told them the route to take, the Texans rode out, keeping their horses at a walk until they were across the creek and well away from the house, in hopes that Teresa wouldn't hear them leaving. If she did, she would want to know where they were going, and then Hardy would have to tell her about Johnny Del Rio. Bo and Scratch hoped to have the youngster safely back on the Half Moon before Teresa even knew that he was gone. The sun had settled behind the Prophets as Bo and Scratch rode east toward Buffalo Flat. Twilight closed in quickly, and they galloped their horses, hoping to make some ground on the young man they sought. Even so, night had fallen by the time they reached the town. They spotted the glow of lights from windows and trotted into the settlement a few minutes later. Bo scanned the buildings for the Colorado Palace as he and Scratch rode past a wagon with a canvas cover parked on the left side of the street, in front of a building with a dim light burning inside it.
Come out of there, honey.
Bo spied a man as he leaned into the wagon and then lurched away from it, dragging a shadowy shape with him. As he stepped into the faint glow coming from the window of the building, it became apparent that he was struggling with a woman. Blonde hair flew around her head as she tried to free herself from his grip. Bo and Scratch reined in sharply. They had hurried to Buffalo Flat from the Half Moon Ranch on a specific errand, but it just wasn't in their nature to ignore somebody in trouble, especially a woman.
Oh, hell!
Bo lunged out of the saddle with Scratch at his heels. Two fast steps brought Bo close enough to grab the man's shoulder and haul him around.
Let the woman go!
Let go of me, you middle little bastard!
He released the woman and swung a punch at Bo's head, moving fairly fast, despite being drunk. Not fast enough, though, because Bo was able to lean back and let the blow pass harmlessly in front of his face. He hooked a hard right into the man's belly, sinking his fist almost to the wrist. Bo hit him with a left that sent him stumbling against the boardwalk. The man fell over backward, sprawling on the planks. The man twisted onto his side and clawed at the butt of the revolver holstered at his waist. He stopped as he heard the metallic sound of a gun hammer being reared back. He stared up to see Scratch aiming a rock-steady Colt rifle at his heart.
I wouldn't if I were you. We're in a hurry. If you make me shoot, I don't have time to do anything but kill you.
The drunk lay there wide-eyed and moved his hand away from his gun. Bo turned toward the woman.
You all right, miss?
She swayed toward him, obviously shaken by the experience, and he put out a hand to steady her.
Get away from her! Let go of her or I'll blast you!
Bo looked over and saw that two more women had just emerged from the building. One of them was pointing a shotgun at him.
Better be careful with that. You fire that scattergun, you'll kill your friend here, too.
Jamie, get away from him! Get back in the wagon!
Bo glanced to the back of the wagon to see another female leveling a Winchester at him.
This ain't a shotgun, mister. I'll drill you if I have to.
Good Lord. Is that blame wagon full of females?
In case you ladies didn't notice, I was trying to help your friend.
He's right, Charity. It was that one who grabbed me.
Janie pointed at the man who still lay on the boardwalk. The red-headed woman who had come out of the building nodded.
All right, it looks like we made a mistake. Put the shotgun down, Lydia.
All right, but I don't like the looks of those two old codgers. You can't blame me for jumping the gun.
Bo might have taken offense at that comment, but the next instant his attention was distracted by the sudden blast of a pistol shot somewhere up the street.
Johnny!
As Bo stepped quickly toward his horse, he pointed at the man lying on the boardwalk.
On your feet and rattle your hocks out of here, amigo. Otherwise, we'll let that lady with the scattergun have you.
The man still seemed to be a little dazed from being knocked around, but he managed to scramble to his feet and lurch off down the boardwalk.
If he comes back, ma'am, don't you hesitate to ventilate the son of a bitch.
You don't worry about that, old-timer.
Scratch frowned at being referred to that way, but didn't say anything. Bo put his foot in the stirrup and swung up into the saddle.
Let's go see what happened.
Side by side, they rode quickly up the street. Before too long, Bo and Scratch spotted the Colorado Palace Saloon to their right. It was a large building, taking up one side of an entire block. The bat-winged entrance was at the corner, providing easy access from both Main Street and the Cross Street. Yellow light spilled through big windows that flanked the doors. A knot of men had gathered to peer over the bat wings, and more were hurrying toward the place. It didn't take any great guesswork to know that the shot had come from inside. The two men drew rein out front.
Son of a bitch.
Yeah.
Hurriedly, they dismounted and wrapped their reins around a hitch rack. Then they stepped up onto the boardwalk and shouldered their way through the crowd. They reached the bat wings and pushed through, moving into the smoky atmosphere of the saloon. Not all the haze came from tobacco, though. Bo recognized the familiar tang of powder smoke. Most of the customers had gone back to drinking or card playing or fondling the percentage gals in scanty spangled outfits, whatever they had been doing before the brief outbreak of violence. People stepped around the body lying sprawled in the front of the bar, leaking crimson into the sawdust that coated the floor. Bo's face hardened as he recognized big, blonde Johnny Del Rio. He glanced over at Scratch and saw him equally grim. Johnny lay on his back. He had been shot once in the chest. His blue eyes stared sightlessly at the fancy crystal chandeliers suspended from the ceiling. Feeling sick and angry at the same time, Bo caught the eye of a bartender.
Are you in the habit in this town of leaving bodies lying on the floor, mister?
The bartender didn't stop polishing the glass in his hand.
Undertaker's been sent for already. What the hell else do you expect us to do?
Who shot this man?
At one of the nearby tables, a man slowly rose to his feet.
What's it to you, cowboy?
He was a tall, broad-shouldered hombre with coal black hair under a tipped-back Stetson. His weathered face was angular, with a wedge of jaw that jutted out defiantly. An ivory-handled Colt rode easily in a black leather holster on his hip.
There was no call to kill him. He was just a kid.
He came in here demanding to see Mr. Cole and blustering about how he was going to kill him. Kid or not, he had to know better than to do something like that. I asked him to leave, and he went for his gun. Simple as that. Ask anybody in here if he didn't draw first.
Bo looked at the man's casual pose, thumb hooked in his belt, but with the right hand still dangerously close to the ivory butt of that gun, and knew that the killer was probably telling the truth. It was likely that Johnny had reached for iron first. But Bo would have been willing to bet there had been some goading before that. It wasn't hard for a gunslinger to prod a less experienced man into drawing first.
Do we know each other? You look a mite familiar.
You don't. You just look like an old man sticking his nose in where it doesn't have any business being. But my name, if that's your way of asking, is Lucas Tate.
I heard tell of you. You've killed what? 3 men? 4?
12.
What I've seen here makes me wonder just how many of them were wet behind the ears kids who didn't stand no chance against you.
Tate stiffened, and his right hand moved slightly so that it hovered over his gun, ready to hook and draw. Folks started to move out of the way as unobtrusively as they could.
It's 2-1, but I don't give a damn. I'm not afraid of you old buzzards.
Wait just a damn minute. There's not going to be any more gunplay in here tonight.
Bo glanced over his shoulder and saw a thick-bodied, middle-aged man coming through the bat wings, followed by a tall, cadaverous-looking gent in a dark suit and hat who had to be the town undertaker. The older man had a lawman's star pinned on his vest and a shotgun in his hands. The badge-toter glanced at the bartender.
Fetch Mr. Cole!
Sure thing, Sheriff.
The man hurried out from behind the hardwood and disappeared through a door at the end of the bar. The sheriff came forward and glanced curiously at Bo and Scratch, then turned his attention to the killer.
Is this one of yours, Tate?
The kid came in practically foaming at the mouth, saying that he was going to kill Mr. Cole. I told him to leave and he went for his gun instead. I didn't have any choice but to ventilate him.
I suppose you got witnesses to back up that story?
Ask anybody in here, except those two old-timers. They weren't even in here when it happened, but they seem to be taking exception to it now.
The sheriff turned back to the Texans and frowned.
Who are you men? I haven't seen you around before.
Name's Creel. This is Morton. We came into town looking for the kid. We all ride for the Half Moon spread.
The Half Moon? Then this killing is tied up with that crazy Kincaid woman?
Badge or no badge, Sheriff, you might want to be careful about calling a woman crazy.
Several men ambushed Mrs. Kincaid this afternoon while she was on her way back to her ranch from buying supplies here in town. She figured they worked for a fella named Cole. When Johnny Del Rio found out about what happened, it upset him. That's why he come to town to have a showdown with Cole. That's when this fella stepped in.
It's my job to protect Mr. Cole from troublemakers. I do it the way I see fit.
You do a fine job of it too, Lucas.
The man who emerged from the door at the end of the bar was a big man with sleekly oiled dark hair and a mustache. He wore an expensive suit, and an equally expensive-looking woman with brown hair followed him out of what appeared to be a private office. The bartender came out last and went back behind the hardwood.
I've already heard the details of this unfortunate incident, Sheriff. Lucas was just doing his duty by confronting that cowboy and trying to convince him to leave peacefully. You certainly can't blame him for defending himself when the kid started the ball.
No, I reckon not.
Watching the sheriff figuratively wag his tail at the man who had to be Cole, Bo knew there was no point in turning to the local law for help. This star packer was tucked away firmly in Cole's hip pocket. The undertaker examined Johnny's body. He stood up and nodded.
I'll get my wagon. I think I already have a coffin that'll fit him just fine.
As the man started past, Bo put out a hand to stop him. He took a $20 gold piece from his pocket and slapped it in the undertaker's palm.
Do it upright.
Sure, mister. Is the deceased kin of yours?
Nope. Never even seen him until a couple hours ago. But we rode for the same brand.
The undertaker nodded again and went out. The sheriff stepped over in front of Bo and Scratch and tucked the shotgun under his arm.
Now, what's this about somebody trying to ambush Mrs. Kincaid?
Four men with rifles hidden in some rocks about halfway between here and her ranch.
Was she hurt?
Nope. She was lucky. We came along about then and took cards in the game.
What happened to the bushwhackers? They get away?
One of them did. I reckon the other three are still laying out there unless the wolves and the coyotes have dragged them off by now.
What? You just left them there?
Bo shrugged in the face of the sheriff's irritation.
They tried to kill a woman, and then they did their damnedest to ventilate my partner and me. I don't figure to lose a whole lot of sleep worrying about what happens to skunks like that.
Bo watched Cole very closely as he mentioned that three of the bushwhackers were dead, and he didn't see the least bit of surprise in the man's eyes. That meant he already knew about it, and that bit of knowledge confirmed the theory that the surviving bushwhacker had come back here to Buffalo Flat to report to Cole. Bo didn't know where the fourth man was now and didn't care. What was important was that he was convinced Teresa Kincaid was right about Cole being responsible for the attempt on her life.
What's the connection between you two and Mrs. Kincaid?
They work for her. At least that's what they claimed a few minutes ago.
You might want to think twice about that, gents. Mrs. Kincaid's got a lot of things mixed up in her head. She's been just about out of her mind with grief ever since rustlers killed her husband a while back.
She seemed plenty sane to me. Seemed like a woman who knows who her real enemies are.
Anyway, I think we're going to like it there. Figure on sticking around for a while.
Well, if you cause any trouble, you'll wind up in my jail. I already got some customers, but I can make room for more. You can count on that.
Bo ignored the man. He knew that the real threats in this room were Cole and Tate, and maybe that sleek brunette who had been back in the office with Cole. She was beautiful, but Beau could see a cold edge in her eyes. They reminded him a little of the eyes of a snake. The Undertaker and a couple of his helpers came into the saloon. They picked up Johnny's body.
Remember what I said about taking care of him properly. We'll let you know whether he's to be buried here in town or if Mrs. Kincaid would like for him to be out on a ranch.
Whatever you say, mister. Doesn't matter to me. I just plant him where I'm told.
The men left with their grim burden, carrying the body out to the wagon that was parked in front of the saloon. A swamper brought a bucket and a mop and started mopping the floor. The sheriff gave Beau and Scratch a hard look.
Is there any other reason for you two men to stay in town tonight?
Not that I know of.
Since it looks like the official response to this killing is just going to be a yawn.
Get! I don't want to see either of you again tonight.
I reckon the feeling's mutual.
Beau and Scratch turned and walked slowly out of the Colorado Palace. As they went, they could practically feel the targets that had been painted on their backs. They had openly declared themselves in the struggle between Teresa Kincaid and Junius Cole.
This used to be a peaceful town. Now there's killings right and left.
Beau wondered what else the sheriff was talking about, but then he put the thought out of his mind. He already had plenty to think about, like how he and Scratch were going to tell Teresa, Hardy, and the others on the Half Moon that Johnny Del Rio was dead. Sam Two Wolves watched his blood brother pace from one side of the cell to the other. That didn't take long. The cell was only about 10 feet by 10 feet, with a bunk on each side and a high barred window in the rear wall.
Take it easy, Matt. We've been in worse places.
I don't like being locked up.
Hell, I'm the Indian.
Sam lay back on the bunk and laced his fingers together behind his head.
I'm the one who's supposed to hate being pinned up so much.
Yeah, well, I don't see how you can lay there taking life easy. We never should have gone along with that damn lawman. It's obvious he's crooked. He's working for Cole, the same bastard who tried to have those gals killed just so they wouldn't come to Buffalo Flat and open up a saloon. He'll probably try to murder us in our sleep tonight.
Then don't sleep. I'll take care of that for both of us.
Sam closed his eyes. Inside that seemingly peaceful exterior, though, he was seething with anger just as much as Matt was. Being stuck in a tiny cell behind gray iron bars was just about the worst thing he could endure.
I thought that Charity gal said her lawyer would get us out of here. Hell, the whole thing was an open and shut case of self-defense. Tully and those other two hombres drew on us first. Everybody in the street saw it.
Maybe nobody who saw it wants to get crossways with Junius Cole. I get the feeling that he's the big he-wolf around here. People don't want to have him as an enemy.
Well, somebody's got to speak up. If they don't, when that pompous jackass of a sheriff gets back,
You'll what? We're locked up, remember?
You don't have to remind me.
A short time earlier, Sheriff Branch had left the office after hearing a gunshot somewhere else in town. It had been a while since that happened, and the sheriff hadn't come back. What if he didn't return to the jail until morning? Sam felt his insides tighten up even more at the thought of that prospect. Matt stopped pacing. Sam sat up and swung his legs off the bunk, hoping that Branch was coming back. Matt went to the door of the cell and gripped the bars tightly. The office door opened, but it wasn't Sheriff Branch who came in. It was Charity McKenzie, accompanied by a fat, bearded man in a town suit. A lawyer, if he'd ever seen one, Sam thought.
Sheriff Branch doesn't appear to be here.
Sam stood up and joined his blood brother at the bars.
Hey, we're back here. Don't leave.
Charity hurried through the door between the office and the cell block, trailed by the lawyer.
There you are. Are you all right?
Why wouldn't they be? Sherman Branch isn't the sort of man who would mistreat his prisoners.
Well, I feel a mite mistreated already, amigo. Being locked up unjustly will do that to a man.
Well, we're here to see about that. I'm Judge A.A. Ashmore, Miss McKenzie's attorney.
I'm sorry it's taken us so long to get here. We went over to the saloon that I inherited, and then there was some trouble there.
We heard a gunshot a while ago. Is that what you were talking about?
No, that was somewhere else. We heard it, too.
Then you're all right?
Yes, we're fine. Drunk came along and pulled Janie out of the wagon, but a couple of old-timers stepped in and stopped him from doing anything worse. She was just scared, not hurt.
It's good to hear that.
After that ruckus was over, Judge Ashmore and I went looking for witnesses to the earlier shooting, the one you were involved in. Lydia and the other girls stayed at the saloon to start cleaning it up.
You reckon they'll be all right there?
As long as Lydia has her shotgun, I think they will be. Anyway, we found some people who are willing to give a statement.
The outer door opened again, and this time it was the lawman who came in, stopping short as he saw Charity and Ashmore standing on the other side of the bars from Bodine and Two Wolves.
What in the blazes going on here? I didn't say those prisoners could have visitors.
You weren't here. Anyway, I think you should release these two men, Sherman.
Ashmore reached inside his coat pocket and pulled out several pieces of paper.
I have here statements from witnesses who are willing to testify that Ed Tully and the other two deceased men reached for their guns first. These gentlemen were just defending themselves, and the ladies who accompanied them.
Branch flipped through the papers before gazing warily at the lawyer.
You're sure you know what you're saying, Judge?
Indeed I do. Despite the fact that these men are strangers and the gents they killed worked for one of the town's leading citizens, legally, you have no case against them. And as an attorney bound by the laws of this state, I would have no choice but to point that out to the presiding judge if the case ever came to trial.
Who gave you those so-called statements?
Casey McLennan, Drew Gilmore, and Phineas O'Toole, for starters.
A man who aren't overly fond of Mr. Cole, in other words. They've had trouble with him in the past.
Men who are respectable, honest citizens of Buffalo Flat. Their word is good, and folks know that, Sherman.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
He walked over to the desk and picked up a ring of keys.
Step back away from the door and I'll let those two out.
Sam felt a wave of relief wash through him, but he tried not to show it. The sheriff unlocked the cell door and swung it open. He stepped back to let Matt and Sam come out.
I reckon you'll be giving us our guns back.
Branch glared at Matt, his face turning red.
I could impound them.
You don't have any cause to do that. Unlike some towns, Buffalo Flat has no ordinance against carrying firearms. But perhaps that's something I should bring up at the next meeting of the town council.
Yeah, you do that.
Branch went to a cabinet and took out the gun belts he had taken earlier from Matt and Sam. Their Colts had been replaced in the holsters. Sam felt even better once he had strapped on the belt and was packing iron again. He knew Matt felt the same way.
You're free to go. If you're smart, you'll get on those horses and get out of Buffalo Flat. There's nothing to keep you here.
Oh, I don't know about that. We haven't had a chance to see much of your town yet except this jail. Could be we'll like it here and want to stay around for a while.
I happen to know that the hotel is full up. No rooms to be had in town.
Actually, that's not true. There are empty rooms upstairs in the Silver Bell.
She ignored the warning look that Ashmore slanted in her direction.
I was thinking about renting them out, and I believe I've just decided to do so.
Judge, is that saloon really her property?
I'm afraid so. Legally, she can do whatever she wants with it.
Lord, the state things have come to.
Charity ignored him and turned to Matt and Sam.
How about it? Would you like to stay at the Silver Bell?
Why, we'd be honored, ma'am.
Actually, they hadn't even discussed what their next move would be, and Sam knew that Matt had accepted Charity's offer as much to annoy the sheriff as anything. But he agreed with the decision, because it was obvious that Charity and her friends had been dealt a tough hand to play, especially without any help. The fact that the local law didn't want to buck Cole made the situation even worse.
Yes, we'll stay around for a while.
It's settled then. Judge Ashmore, if you'll send me a bill for your services tonight, I'll see that it's paid.
The judge ain't married. Maybe he'd like to take out what you owe in trade, missy.
Sam put a hand on his blood brother's arm as he saw the look that ignited in Matt's eyes at Branch's coarse words.
Come on, let's get out of here.
Bodine shrugged off the restraining hand.
In a minute. I met a lot of fine lawmen in my time, Sheriff. And you sure as shit ain't one of them.
Get the hell out of my office!
Be seeing you.
Judge Ashmore remained behind as Matt, Sam, and Charity left the sheriff's office. Matt paused on the boardwalk outside, slowly unclenching his fists. Sam put a comforting hand on his shoulder.
I know. That lawman's crooked as a dog's hind leg. And an unpleasant cuss to boot. But he's still a lawman. You gun him down and we'll have every star packer in the state after us.
Yeah, I know. As long as he steers clear of us, I'll steer clear of him. But if he was 10 years younger, I'd have put a fist right in his face and taken my chances on giving him a whipping.
If he was 10 years younger, you'd have probably had to stand in line behind me to do that.
If you two are through trying to impress me with how big and tough you are, those rooms are waiting for you down at the Silver Bell.
You really want us to stay there?
I know that sometimes I'm too proud for my own good, especially considering where I came from and what I used to do. But I'm not a fool, Mr. Bodine. I know the deck is stacked against us here in Buffalo Flat. The girls and I need someone on our side, someone who can stand up to Cole and his men.
There's no guarantee we can do that.
Sam squeezed Matt's shoulder once before letting go, and the three of them walked down the boardwalk toward the Silver Bell.
On the contrary, you've already done it. I get the feeling that nobody has traded shots with Cole's men and come out on top for a long time. Maybe ever.
In other words, you want a war with him?
No, that's not what I want. But Cole fired the opening shot, and I'm damn sure not ready to surrender. Cole's the one who wants the war.
And you're going to give it to him?
I'm going to give it to him in spades.
When they got to the Silver Bell, they found the other women working industriously, despite the fact that the hour was getting late. At Sam's questioning glance, Lydia grinned at him.
We're used to working late.
Becky was cleaning fly specks off the big mirror behind the bar, while Wilma was polishing the hardwood itself. Around in front of the bar, Kathy worked on the brass foot rail, while behind it, Lydia dusted the bottles arrayed below the mirror on the back bar. Janie had found a broom somewhere and was sweeping the floor. She already had a pile of dust swept up and was pushing it toward the open doors. One of them had climbed up on a stepladder and filled and lit the oil lamps in one of the silver chandeliers, so plenty of light now illuminated their efforts. All the women had paused in their work as Charity came in with Matt and Sam. Janie leaned on her broom and smiled at Matt.
You're back! I knew that old sheriff couldn't keep you locked up in jail, Mr. Bodine.
Actually, it was Charity here who was responsible for getting us out. And Mr. Bodine is my pa. I'm Matt, remember? That goes for all of you.
Are you going to be staying here?
We're going to rent a couple of the upstairs rooms to Mr. Bodine and Mr. Two Wolves. I mean, Matt and Sam.
You're going to charge them rent after what they've done for us so far?
Sam and I insist. In fact, we'd be plumb honored to be the Silver Bell's first paying customers under the new ownership. Wouldn't we, Sam?
Sure.
Matt took a coin from his pocket and dropped it on the bar.
Let's get started by having a drink. That is, if any of that Who Hit John left over from before is still fit to drink.
Lydia picked up one of the bottles she had just dusted and pulled the cork from its neck. She took a sniff, considered for a moment, and then nodded.
Smells like decent booze. Not too much strychnine, rattlesnake juice, and puma piss.
Fetch some glasses.
Actually, if you could rustle up a pot of coffee, ma'am, I'd appreciate it. I'm not much of a drinker.
That's right. He's half redskin, can't handle his liquor.
And since I know that it means there's a smaller chance I'll wind up a drunken bum lying in some gutter, a fate that may well be waiting for someone I know.
I thought you two were friends. Blood brothers, right?
One homahan. Some say it means brothers of the wolf.
That doesn't mean we can't see each other's faults. Right, you stiff-necked, overeducated half-breed?
Right, you drunken, irresponsible hillbilly.
Come to think of it, though, a pot of coffee does sound pretty good right now.
There's a kitchen in the back.
Lydia recorked the bottle of whiskey and returned it to the back bar.
I'll see what I can do.
She must have found a bag of coffee and a pot, because a few minutes later, the familiar potent aroma of Arbuckles drifted out of the kitchen into the main room of the saloon. While they were waiting for it, Charity motioned Matt and Sam over to one of the tables, and the three of them sat down.
I just wanted you to know, you don't really have to pay rent for those rooms. I appreciate your willingness to do that, but...
Don't worry about that. We can afford it. What I'm more concerned about is how you intend to handle this problem with Cole.
He's the one making it a problem, not me. I don't care about his saloon. I just want to run mine. If he leaves us alone, we'll leave him alone.
But we all know that's not the way it's going to be, more than likely. If he's worried enough, or arrogant enough, to want to wipe out the competition before it even gets to town, he's not going to just sit back and let you operate the Silver Bell unmolested.
I'm afraid you're right. He'll try something else. I just don't know what it is yet.
Whatever it is, Sam and I will be here to help.
Charity leaned back in her chair and smiled.
If this keeps up, I'm going to have to put you on the payroll. Wait a minute. I could give you each a share of this place in return for helping us.
That's not necessary.
He's right.
Charity glanced over at her friends, who were still hard at work making the saloon more presentable.
The girls don't know it yet, but all of them are getting a share. It's only fair after they gave up their own lives to come with me and start over out here.
I imagine that was a sacrifice they were more than willing to make.
Maybe so, but I still intend to do right by them. I'd like to do the same where you two are concerned.
Well, you can forget about giving us shares. Shoot, the last thing in the world we want to be is tied down to some business. Isn't that right, Sam?
We're pretty undependable. Here today, gone tomorrow, as the old saying goes.
Fiddle-footed, that's us.
You won't catch us putting down roots.
No, ma'am, we just naturally get ourselves an itch to mosey along.
All right, that's enough. I get the idea. But you'll stay until things are settled with Cole, won't you?
We wouldn't miss it for the world.
Lydia emerged from the kitchen with a coffee pot and a tray full of cups, and everyone gathered around as she began to pour. When they each had a cup of the strong black brew, Lydia lifted her cup.
Maybe it's not an official toast without a little hooch involved, but here's to the Silver Bell, and to Charity McKenzie.
Charity swallowed hard and blinked back tears.
And here's to all of you, the best friends a girl could ever have.
And to our new friends, Matt and Sam.
The eight cups clinked together over the bar. Hardy Thomas heard the hoofbeats as Bo and Scratch approached the ranch. The Half Moon's foreman stepped out of the bunkhouse with a rifle in his hands.
Who's that yonder?
Bo and Scratch, Hardy.
Mort Skaggs and Hector Abinez emerged from the bunkhouse too and joined Hardy as he hurried to meet the Texans.
Did you find Johnny?
We found him, Mort, but you ain't gonna like what we got to tell you.
God damn it.
Hector crossed himself and bowed his head in prayer.
Kid's dead, ain't he?
Bo and Scratch swung down from their saddles. Both looked tired and frustrated.
I'm afraid so. We found him in the Colorado Palace. He'd been shot by a man named Lucas Tate.
Tate? That son of a bitch is nothing but a murdering gunslinger.
Yeah, I reckon he prodded young Johnny into drawing on him, knowing full well that kid didn't have a chance.
We ought to ride into town.
And what? Get killed so that Mrs. Kincaid has even less help than she does now? I know Scratch and I are strangers here, and I don't mean to sound harsh, but it seems to me that the worst thing you can do right now is to give Tate and the rest of Cole's hired killers an opportunity to gun you down.
You're right, Creel. I know you're right. But it's mighty damn hard to sit back and do nothing when that poor kid was as good as murdered. Now, here's the really hard part. Somebody's got to go in there and tell Miss Kincaid what happened.
Did Johnny have any kinfolk around here?
Not that I know of. He claimed to be from down in the Texas border country somewhere. Could be that Del Rio wasn't even his real name. Might have left Texas 2 jumps ahead of the Rangers. Even good men get crosswise with the law sometimes.
I'll talk to Mrs. Kincaid. She's going to have to decide whether she wants Johnny buried out here on the ranch or in town. His body is at the undertaking parlor tonight.
There's a little burial ground up on top of the hill back yonder. That slope there rising up behind the ranch house. That's where the boss is laid to rest, along with his first wife and the baby they lost. And a few other hands who bit the dust while they was working here.
William Kincaid was married before, eh?
That's right. Some years back. Wife died whilst giving birth. And the young'un didn't make it neither. Losing them both like that hit Will mighty hard. Took him years to get over it. And then when he did get over it and married the current Ms. Kincaid, it was only a few months before some murdering bushwhacker shot him in the back. But at least he got to be happy again for a little while.
Scratch, if you'll tend to the horses, I'll go talk to Mrs. Kincaid.
You sure you don't want me to come along?
No, I can handle this chore.
Bo left Scratch and the ranch hand standing in front of the bunkhouse and strode toward the main house. All the windows were dark. Teresa Kincaid had turned in for the night, not knowing that Johnny Del Rio had headed for Buffalo Flat to settle the score for the attempt on her life. Bo climbed onto the porch and paused in front of the door.
Mrs. Kincaid! Mrs. Kincaid, it's Bo Creel!
After a couple of minutes passed, he saw a light through the window. A moment later, the door swung open to reveal Teresa standing there holding a lamp. She wore a robe belted tightly around her waist, and her blonde hair was tousled from sleep. Beau took his hat off and held it to his chest.
Beau, what is it? Something wrong?
Yes, ma'am, I'm afraid so. I have some bad news for you.
You and Scratch aren't leaving, are you?
No, ma'am, it's worse than that.
What is it?
Earlier this evening, Johnny Del Rio left the ranch and rode to Buffalo Flat. He was angry about what happened this afternoon and wanted to have a showdown with Junius Cole. But he never got to see Cole. A man named Lucas Tate killed him in a gunfight in the Colorado Palace Saloon.
Johnny? Johnny is dead?
I'm afraid so. Scratch and I went after him in hopes that we could head him off before he got into trouble, but we were too late.
He thought about how the two of them had stopped to intervene when that drunk was manhandling the young blonde from the wagon. The shot that had killed Johnny had come after that incident, which meant that if they hadn't paused, they might have gotten to the youngster in time to keep him from drawing on Lucas Tate. The knowledge of that possibility had gnawed quite a bit on Beau's guts during the ride back out here from the settlement. On the other hand, there was no telling what might have happened if he and Scratch hadn't stepped in to help the young woman. That might have ended tragically, too. A man couldn't dwell too much on what might have been, because it would drive him loco if he did. Tears welled from Teresa's eyes and rolled down her cheeks as she looked up at him.
That foolish boy. He only did it because he was smitten with me.
No, ma'am, I don't think so. I think it was more a matter of him riding for the brand. Hardy and Mort and Hector all wanted a shot at Cole, too. But they're old enough not to give in to the impulse.
Johnny wasn't. And now he'll never get any older.
Johnny's body is at the undertaker's in Buffalo Flat. We'll need to ride into town first thing in the morning, let him know where the burial will be. Hardy and the boys said they didn't think Johnny had any family around here.
If he did, I never heard about it. He'll be buried here on the ranch.
Sounds fine to me, ma'am. Scratch and I will take care of it in the morning.
No, we'll take care of it. All of us. We'll all go into town and get him.
I don't know if that's a good idea. That would leave the spread undefended. It'd practically be an engraved invitation for Cole's men to come in and burn all the buildings to the ground.
I didn't think about that. You're right, of course. We'll leave the other members of the crew here to keep an eye on the place. But I'm going along with you and Mr. Morton, and I won't listen to any arguments about that.
I guess it's settled, then. We'll start first thing in the morning. Ought to be back here by the middle of the day.
That'll be fine.
Teresa laid a hand on his arm.
Thank you for trying to save him, Beau.
I wish I'd been able to, ma'am.
He put on his hat and nodded politely to her. She nodded back and retreated into the house, gently shutting the door. Beau turned to head back to the bunkhouse. He found Scratch was waiting for him out front, a quirly dangling from his lips.
How'd she take it?
About as well as can be expected. She wants to take the buckboard into town in the morning to get Johnny, bring him back out here to be buried.
Don't surprise me. We'll be going with her, I reckon.
Damn right. She first said everybody would go, but I pointed out that that would leave the place with nobody to watch it.
Cole's men would get up to mischief for sure if that happened.
Yeah, I pointed that out, and Mrs. Kincaid went along with me.
Well, we better turn in then if we're getting an early start in the morning. You know, it's been a long day.
Yeah, not long enough for some, though. Poor kid. Come on then, let's go.
Despite the long trip and the two gunfights, Matt had fallen asleep easily and woke up the next morning feeling refreshed. After making himself presentable, he went downstairs to find Sam already sitting at one of the tables, a cup of coffee and a plate full of bacon and flapjacks in front of him. Lydia waved at Matt from behind the bar.
Sit down, Matt. I'll bring you your breakfast.
About time you rattled your hawks out of bed. Have you looked outside? That bright, shiny stuff? It's called sunlight.
It's not that late.
Matt glanced through the windows at the brilliant morning and winced.
I'm a growing boy. I need my sleep. It was a quiet night, right? No trouble?
No trouble. Don't worry. You didn't sleep through another gunfight. I guess Cole felt like it would be pushing it to try anything else so soon.
We need to go see this fella Cole, sort of introduce ourselves.
I reckon we'll get around to that soon enough.
Lydia came over to the table with another cup of coffee and a plate heaped high with food. She set the fine meal before Matt.
Here you go.
Where's everybody else?
Except for Charity. They're all upstairs asleep, I reckon. Like I said last night, we're more used to late hours. And I suppose it'll stay that way, running a saloon. I sort of like to get up and rustle a good breakfast for folks, though.
Where's Charity? You said she wasn't upstairs.
We're running low on supplies. Just about used up all we brought with us. So Charity went over to the store to see about getting some delivered later today.
Matt frowned and sat up straighter, his morning languor disappearing. Sam wasn't as relaxed anymore either.
She went by herself?
I'm not sure that's a good idea.
I told her that if she waited, one or both of you gents would probably be glad to go with her, but she wouldn't hear of it. She said she'd be perfectly fine in the middle of town in broad daylight. That Cole wouldn't dare try anything under those circumstances. Huh, that gal is nothing if not headstrong.
Matt and Sam both scraped their chairs back and stood up.
And she's likely right, but with no law except that tame sheriff to worry about, there's really no telling what Cole might do.
We better go make sure that she's all right.
Oh, but your breakfast.
It'll have to wait.
Matt and Sam started toward the door, but it opened before they could get there, and Charity walked in.
Where are you two going? Sit down and eat.
You're all right?
I'm fine. I told Lydia it wouldn't be a problem for me to go to the store.
And I told them, but they're about as stubborn as you are.
You were coming to check on me.
We've run into men like Cole before. They think they're a law unto themselves and can do whatever they want.
Well, I'm touched by your concern. Right now, though, I want you to sit down and have your breakfast. I have a job for you later if you want it.
What's that?
After I went to the general store to buy some supplies, which will be delivered here later this morning, by the way, I stopped at the newspaper. I thought the editor might be interested in doing a story about the Silver Bell being open for business again.
He'd take you up on it?
Well, no. I think he might have, but his wife was there. Evidently, she keeps his books for him, and she didn't seem too keen on the idea that a place like this is newsworthy. But the editor also takes on outside printing jobs, so I made arrangements for him to print up some flyers advertising the business. Since they'd be making money on that, his wife agreed to it.
Can we afford that?
Barely. But they say you have to spend money to make money.
Matt and Sam exchanged a glance. If the gals ran short of funds, they would be glad to loan them some money. Charity might put up a fuss about taking it, though.
Those flyers should be ready about 11 o'clock, he said. I thought maybe you wouldn't mind getting them and tacking them up around town?
Doesn't sound like too complicated a chore.
I reckon we can manage it.
Good. I imagine word has already spread around town about the saloon opening again, but I want people to know that they can start coming here right away. While I was at the store, I bought a sheet and a can of paint, too. I'm going to paint a big sign that says Grand Reopening and hang it up outside.
That ought to get Cole's goat.
I don't care about Cole's goat or anything else about him. I just want to get the business off to a good start.
The Blood Brothers resumed their breakfast. For a retired whore, Lydia was a mighty good cook, Matt thought, but he kept that assessment to himself, just in case she might take it the wrong way. Since they had some time before they would need to pick up the flyers at the newspaper office, they turned their hand to some chores around the saloon that the women might have trouble handling. A section of the railing around the balcony was a little loose, so Sam found a hammer and some nails in the storeroom off the kitchen and set about repairing it. Matt took a saw and a piece of lumber from a pile in the alley out back and began cutting a replacement board for one of the stair risers that had a hole kicked in it sometime in the past. Those and a few other similar tasks kept them busy as the morning passed. The other women were still upstairs asleep when Bodine and Two Wolves left the saloon and walked across the street and down a couple of blocks to the newspaper office. The editor and publisher, a man in his 30s with a neatly trimmed dark beard, had the flyers ready for them when they explained who they were. He was alone, his wife having left on an errand.
I've heard about you two. If you ask me, Junius Cole doesn't know what he's getting into if you're taking the side of those women.
Those women have a right to be here. Miss Mackenzie is the legal owner of the Silver Bell.
Oh, I'm not disputing that. To tell you the truth, I wish Miss Mackenzie luck. There are a lot of people in Buffalo Flat who'd like to see Cole taken down a notch or two, and I'm one of them. I'm Casey McLennan.
He extended an ink-stained hand and introduced himself.
You're one of the men who gave statements to Judge Ashmore yesterday evening about the gunfight with Cole's gunnies.
That's right. I saw the whole thing and was glad to speak up on your behalf. I would have put a story about it in next week's paper, but my wife doesn't like stories that she says glorify violence.
Standing up for what's right isn't the same thing as glorifying violence.
I agree with you, but some people don't.
Well then, I'm lucky I've never been one to give much of a hoot in hell about what some people think.
Matt picked up the stack of flyers.
I believe Miss McKenzie's already paid you for these.
That's right. And if I could offer one word of advice, watch your backs. I know about your reputations, but Cole has some dangerous men working for him. Especially one named Lucas Tate.
Tate? I've heard of him. He's fast, and he's got ice water in his veins.
That's him, all right.
Despite what you may have heard about us, we don't go hunting for trouble. We'll keep an eye out for Cole's men, but we won't start any fights.
Won't run from any either.
That's about what I figured.
They left the newspaper office. Sam had brought along the hammer he had been using at the saloon and a pocket full of nails.
Let's put some of these up by the corral and the public watering trough. Lots of folks pass by there in a day's time.
I was thinking more about plastering the front wall of the Colorado Palace with them.
Remember what I said about not hunting for trouble? That's Cole's place.
I know.
They walked toward the eastern end of town. When they reached the corral, Matt handed one of the flyers to Sam, who tacked it onto a post with a couple of nails. The flyer read, Silver Bell Saloon, now open. New owner invites everyone to come in for the best drinks and best times in Buffalo Flat. As Sam stepped back from the post and looked at the sign, he nodded in satisfaction.
That'll get my attention, all right.
They turned to walk away and look for another place to display one of the flyers. They had only gone a few feet.